Welcome to Globally Speaking, a podcast dedicated to unlocking global understanding. Join us as we engage with experts and innovators who are reshaping the way we connect with global audiences. Whether seeking to refine your approach, wanting to expand your understanding of AI and its role in transcending global communication barriers, or just curious about the intricacies of global content, this podcast promises to enlighten and inspire.
Hi, hello and welcome to this mini-series of Globally Speaking on the future of human-machine collaboration, which we call Genuine Intelligence. I'm Emma Fisher, VP Global Marketing at RWS, and I'm joined today by Melanie Peterson, Senior Programme Director of Train AI at RWS. Hi, Melanie. Do you want to give yourself a quick introduction and about yourself and your role at RWS?
Thanks, Emma. Yes, my name is Melanie Peterson. I'm the Senior Director at RWS for Train AI, and I'm mainly responsible for client delivery and operations, working very closely with sales, marketing, and solutions here.
Thank you. So early this year, we released a report outlining our philosophy on the future of human and AI, which we call Genuine Intelligence. And the theme, the report had six key themes that underpinned it. Today, we're going to dive a bit deeper into AI data training, and the theme specifically around is called No Shortcuts, which is very much about exploring the potential of the self-destructive path of uncontrolled AI growth against the backdrop of AI developed with ethical standards and human-centric values. And so this is probably a good place to start to explain a bit more about what we mean by AI data training. You know, what is it and what part does it play in our daily lives?
I think probably one of the most basic analogies I always use for people is when you're helping teach something to learn, the same way that a child would read a book and learn from it. But it can be as basic as something, for instance, where you give a person an image and you ask it to label the tree and label the ground, label a bench, label a person. And you do that over and over and over again, so that we're really helping the engine learn that every time I see this type of image, this is a tree. Now we're obviously getting a lot more complex now with LLMs and how we're introducing specialists and things like that. But really, just on the very basic level, it's just that repetitive nature of showing a computer how to learn.
So you mentioned specialists there. You know, how when we're training models, or language specialists and the teams that work with you, how critical is the role of subject matter experts in training AI models, especially when developing specialist models? You know, what are the benefits of incorporating that expert knowledge into the data training process?
This is something that's really evolved. I think I've been involved in data training since over 15 years, starting in 2010 with my first introduction with IBM Watson. And at that time, we really didn't think about the specialist being involved. It was more of the generalist. You really just wanted to throw a lot of people at it, not specialized people to work on things. And now, as we're getting into the Gen AI world and LLMs, the specialist has become crucial in ensuring that whatever we're giving the engines to learn really is specialized. So, you know, you don't want to have me, for instance, answer questions about, medical devices or surgery, right? We want someone who has studied their whole life in there. So really making sure that you have the right people answering those questions to give validity to the content of the output is so crucial. And something that I think in the industry is really you're at an inflection point where we're really starting to see that. And just it's changing so much. Well, all the time, right? You know, we know that this business is changing all the time, but we're really seeing that push from our clients, just from us, from what we see in our testing, to really evolve that that model to the specialized.
You mentioned when we were in person a few weeks ago, Melanie, it's not just kind of the regulated side of things, but there's also subject matter experts in, you know, opera singers and all the different types of jobs. Yeah. Give us a couple of examples of those, because they're interesting to me in terms of the different types of specialists when you're training data models.
Yeah, you brought up the opera singer, one of my favorite people who worked on a project. And, you know, when we first were approached by this client, like, we need these types of of people, and you're like, opera singer, where am I going to find an opera singer? And why is that important? But it is important because if you want to ask, you know, any model about opera, you know, again, you don't want, you know, a stay-at-home mom or a surgeon answer that question. And he became one of my favorite people. I love our community so much because I don't know, they teach me something different every day. But yes, we have an opera singer. We had a specialist on cars. He's like one of the biggest car enthusiasts. He has some published books, you know, so really just, it's crazy the amount of people that you get to meet and learn from. And, you know, the computers are learning, but so are we, because it's really cool to get to really, you know, we call it human in the loop. I think we talk about that in our report as well, but it really is important that you understand that there is a human, a really, in most parts, a really cool human who is working on this stuff to make it, you know, make the output as good as it can be.
So yeah, human in the loop, expert in the loop, you know, all of those, the importance of having that human piece when it comes to, you know, the AI model output, as you said. One of the things that we cover in the report is that AI models in general sometimes are relying too much on AI generated data instead of that human generated or that human validated content. You know, what are the risks that can create? You know, could we be witnessing, you know, that phenomenon where you know, AI is eating itself, and you know, is becoming and degrading in the quality of the output?
Absolutely. This is one of the most crucial things when we talk about to our clients, when we talk at specialized events, is it's so easy to think like, oh, I can save money and not do this extra step of having the validation of humans. But then you're just relying on the computer to teach itself over and over again. Mm. I saw a really great analogy, and I think you saw it too, Emma. And I think it's a really good, probably easy way for everyone to think about this, right? So if you ask the AI for shapes and it comes back with two squares, a triangle, and a circle, you're like, okay, well, it gave me shapes. That's fine. But then if you continue to then not correct it and say, remove one of these squares and introduce, say, a trapezoid, it's going to think that you really like those squares. So the next time you run the model and you ask it, can you show me an example of shapes? It's going to give you three squares and a triangle. And then if you don't intervene again, it's going to be like, well, I'm really doing well. Melanie really likes this. Now I'm going to give her four squares. But now you've taken away all the other shapes because the AI model thinks it's really just you're happy with squares, right? I think it's just a really easy, because I was talking to someone about this and they really were having a hard time understanding what I was talking about with like an AI teaching itself. And I saw that example. If you don't ever correct the model, if it's teaching itself, if it thinks that what it's doing is okay, then it's not gonna punish itself, right? It's like, great, I'm doing a good job.
Well, that's a great example of generative AI wanting to help you. You know, it's wanting to give you an answer, and the helpfulness of it often. We've heard about hallucinations. It leads into hallucinations because it gives you something that it thinks you want to see based on the experience that it's had. And as you've just said, if the experience, we haven't corrected it as humans, or haven't trained it, or haven't corrected, then these hallucinations or biases creep in. Have you got any good kind of real world examples of hallucinations, and you know, how can companies prevent it?
Yeah, I actually just did a talk a couple months ago, and I was talking about this to a group of legal group, and we were talking about I think it was about 3 or 4 years ago with the first instances of ChatGPT. I think a lawyer had asked it for some help for a court case, and ChatGPT made up a bunch of court cases. Mm. And this lawyer, instead of actually validating that any of these were true, presented them to the court, and the court judge checked it, the clerk checked it, and they were like, these are not real. So what an embarrassing, I mean, it's sort of a great example of this person thinking like, oh, I found the shortcut. I can have ChatGPT help me, but then ended up being a huge faux pas, an embarrassment to him, an embarrassment to his company, and just a really good reason that while all of these models right now can help you, like, we still need to validate that they're true and that you have the right people checking the output of the data.
So one of the things that you're saying is that, you know, companies can really prevent that by improving the data validation process, incorporating more human oversight to verify those model outputs, and particularly in high stake fields like law, medicine, finance, you know, that's where it's exactly. becoming even more critical to have that human oversight as part of the data validation process. What do you think the risks are of launching AI models without enough oversight? You know, can you share a couple of examples? I think it'd be good to get a couple of funny examples, a couple of serious examples as you give us them.
Yeah, I mean, of course, obviously the biggest risk is bias. We talk about it all the time. If you don't have any oversight, are we ensuring that these models are as bias-free as possible? You know, we also talked about the hallucinations. Like, these are all examples of things that are happening without the oversight, without the humans in the loop, without having, in that case, obviously the output had not been validated by a legal team. So you asked about funny and serious examples. I think one of the funniest ones that is my favorite, and we recently did this last year for the TrainAI marketing marketing campaign, is the salmon. And, you know, it was a great example of a hallucination because someone put into the model about, you know, can you show me a salmon swimming upstream? And of course you would expect a fish to be shown there. And instead they showed a fillet of salmon, right? Like this ready to be cooked on the barbecue. And I think that's personally one of my favorite examples of a hallucination in real time. We used it in the campaign. I had it as my backdrop for a while because it's just so funny. I don't know why I like it so much, but I do.
I saw one actually of an AI model with, in terms of image recognition, where it misidentified a cloud formation as a sheep. As well, that was another funny one that I saw.
And I think it was UC Berkeley had an example where they overtrained a model with panda images, and so then it was like introducing anything that sort of looked like a panda, they would introduce all these panda images into their models. So yeah, I guess it really likes the animals, and I think those are funny. Serious, I think, going back to some of my experience with Watson. And talking about medical and lawyers, there was a overzealous model that introduced some cancer treatment, and that cancer treatment was not accurate. So had it not been used and had it not been validated, it was caught during some of the testing, you know, that would have been a very serious issue for someone who was depending on a life-saving intervention, and instead, you know, had AI produce a result for them. So, you know, that's why, you know, we can laugh about the salmon or the sheep, like those are funny outputs. But then, you know, the other side of it, the really serious side of AI going unchecked can have dire consequences.
And as technology advances as well, thinking of things like self-driving cars, and, you know, the models at the minute are kind of limited data sets that have been trained have failed to kind of recognize pedestrians or even make those decisions in terms of, you know, certain road scenarios that could lead to accidents, and, you know, the kind of misinterpretation or the lack of sufficient testing and oversight before deployment. So yeah, there's lots of different examples I think that could be.
I still haven't been in a self-driving car. One of our colleagues recently was, and I was like, were you scared out of your mind while you were in that? But I mean, it's really cool to think that they exist, but they're still, you know, I don't know. I still like a human in the loop driving my car, you know?
Well, yeah. And it's that kind of decision making that you can make as a human, because you have kind of the emotion be able to decide what, you know, where to steer versus kind of having that model that's been trained. So I think there's some serious progress that we need to make with regards to those kind of technology as well as data training. So so in terms of moving on from actual kind of AI models to actually the training itself, in terms of how we practice kind of responsible AI, kind of the data training and how the data collection and data training itself can be done responsibly. So we've spoken a bit about the output, but in terms of the input to help us to make sure that we are, as an organization for our clients, that we are, you know, ensuring that the company has a responsible approach to training AI.
Yeah, this is changing by the minute, I think, even more as the regulatory oversight becomes more, definitely paying a lot more attention. Obviously, the EU has launched a lot of new regulations, things that we're learning all the time. But even before thinking about regulations, you know, it's if you're talking about data collection, by the minute we get fewer options on where we can collect data, because, you know, is it copyrighted? Do we have the right to take it? We can't just go anywhere on the internet and take someone's work and claim it as a collection. But once upon a time, they did that. You know, they just, many companies would just scrape the internet or have those bots to scrape, which just is a no-no in today's world. That's sort of why I think it ties to your earlier question, why we're seeing more created content, because when you're creating content for these endeavors, it's safer. You know where it's coming from. You can validate what it is. You know, also when we talk about responsible AI, not only it's like where we're collecting it, who we're collecting it from. You know, if you're taking people's voice samples, you know, we're making sure that we're ensuring consent, that they know what it's going to be used for. There's no sort of bait and switch. You know, it's really important to have all those privacy and consent and regulations in there. And also, you know, tied to the responsible AI is making sure that you're having voices from all over, making sure that you have diverse opinions, locations, and things like that. And also paying people fairly that are working on your projects. You know, we know in this industry there has been a lot of acts of not using resources and not paying them fairly. And so, you know, I think there's a lot of things that go into responsible AI. Just those are some of them for me that are always top of mind.
How does the way AI is trained impact on its performance? We've spoken about kind of having the right ethics and the right community and the right kind of the processes in place. But, you know, how is the way that it's trained help, you know, impact its performance, and why is the quality and the kind of diversity of data so important?
AI is always looking for a pattern, right? So it's like, it kind of ties back to that square thing. That's an easy pattern to recognize, but it's looking for patterns of behaviors or patterns of opinions in order to base its answers on. So when you don't have a diverse influence in the model, for instance, it's going to pick up on just one sort of opinion or lack of diverse model. I always use this example. I think it's one that's important. It's like, if I gave you one book your whole life, Emma, you would only know that one book, right? But if I gave you 100,000 books from all over the world with all different opinions, all different diversity, imagine how much more open-minded or broad facts that you have. So it's just really important, because if you have poor training, if you're only giving one opinion, you're going to have inaccurate predictions, you're going to have lack of model robustness, and then you're just really worried about the quality. It's one person, one opinion, one place, whatever those things are, that's not high quality. It's just, that becomes just easy instead of diverse in its model predictions.
So poor quality or incomplete data leads to models that make kind of less accurate or biased predictions.
Yes,
is what you're saying. Moving on to kind of transparency, you know, why is it crucial to be transparent? You mentioned it, you touched on it a minute ago. You know, what are the risks if it's not clear or it's not reliable?
I mean, I think it really ties to, you know, we were talking about this just a minute ago. There's the continuing evolution of our regulatory environment that we really must be vigilant to. And we need to be able to stand by where and how we're sourcing any data that we're helping our clients train their models on. So if we can't say with 100% accuracy where the data is coming from, then we can't deliver the sort of explainability for our clients. So it just becomes really crucial for their credibility, and then, you know, in turn for our credibility, because we want to be partners and ensuring that, you know, as a company, we have the best available output. We know where it comes from. We can stand up to anyone asking anything about it.
We had a stat actually, Melanie, in our report around the accuracy and reliability of Gen AI outputs, and 53% of the audience that we researched, so we researched 200 executives globally, were concerned about the accuracy and the reliability as it becomes more prevalent in our daily lives. You know, I think the last question I have for you based on that stat is, how can we ensure that training data really reflects the global diversity and avoids cultural bias so that we can ensure that it's more accurate and reliable? You know, what can companies do to address this?
Yeah, I think it's really important from my perspective when we look at sourcing a project. You know, let's just say it's English because it gives us a sort of a world option. You know, it's, you really want to have the most broad geographic and cultural representation. So for instance, in an English model, if we're helping build an English model, you know, you don't want to just have one section of the US, you know, everyone from New York City. You want to ensure broad diversity of the United States. You want to go to Canada, you want to go to Australia, you want to go to the UK, you know, any place that's predominantly using US as their native tongue is going to be really important, because you're not only getting, you know, a US opinion, you're also adding the UK, you have a European mindset in that, you could even add South Africa, you know, having all of these different locations is crucial, because none of us think alike. I mean, just even think of the UK, right? You're there. No one in, you know, the north of the UK, London, you know, the countryside, everyone has a different opinions, different ways that they grew up. It's the same in the United States. You know, the north is not the same as the west, it's not the same as the south. And it's really important for us that when we're sourcing for these, we're looking at all of those to make sure that we have the best representation across all of these places so that we can stand by what we're doing. It's also really important looking at your guidelines, making sure that the guidelines are as clear as possible and sort of as strict as possible, because you don't want anyone, you want them following exactly what they need to do in the project and not sort of making their own rules up as they go. You know, so like I want to have the exact same guideline as you do, Emma. So, you know, I live in the United States. I'm going to do the same thing as you are in the UK. And that helps us stand behind the training that we're providing as a company.
So I'm going to just kind of finish on one question around our community, just because I'm genuinely interested in you know, the talented pool of people that we have globally. Tell us a bit more about the Train AI community and why we call them a community, and you know, what makes the community a bit different from others.
Absolutely. I think, well, Emma, you know me well, so you know my passion for our community. I think our product is our community. Like that is one of the things that I feel very lucky in my position to be able to have such such cool access to our community. You know, in other places call them crowd, or, you know, they use other terms. And to me, it really just isn't a reflection of who they are. They are, in some cases, our employees, in some cases, part of our community. But whatever they are part of our RWS, and we want them to feel part of our RWS. We want them to work here. We want them to love their work. You know, sometimes it can be more boring than other projects they're doing. We want them to love working for us. We have great wellness programs. We check in with our community. We have spotlights. We bring them into client meetings. You know, we spotlight them in internal meetings as well. I think you highlighted that too, Emma. So I think what I try to achieve when we're creating our community is to stand above the competitors, to say, we really value you. We would be lost without you. And how can we help you achieve whatever it is you're looking to achieve? Because when you do that, you know, we achieve something as well. So really, I really love getting to talk with our community and to interact with them and work with them, because they really are our product. And I feel very lucky to work with them.
And when you say them, I mean, it's like 100,000 plus of kind of active, big.
It's big,
and you know,
it is
I think
big,
to do that. See that at scale, Melanie, is something that, you know, it's really great to hear the passion there, because ultimately it's not just a one size fits all. And I think that's what we're hearing today is, you know, it's a real kind of curated effort of, you know, specialists in different domains and different continents and different cultures and languages.
Exactly.
And, you know, that's what makes it kind of super special for me.
Too.
It must be quite good, quite amazing really to work with. So I think, you know, on that, you've answered all the questions. I think you've had a kind of, it's been a great session to hear a bit more about Train AI specifically. So thank you, Melanie, for your time today, and appreciated your kind of really well-rounded responses. Thank you.
Thank you.